of the kind of presidency that this has been. It's all been one huge grift. It's all been one huge scam. And I think that perhaps the most long-term danger, the short-term crisis is unconscionable, the number of people that have been killed and made sick because of incompetence. But on a long-term level, if Joe Biden wins and becomes president, and we don't reckon with how we got here, with how Donald Trump was created, nurtured in this system and able to seize power, then I really fear for the future of this country, because this is the tip of the iceberg. Seeing someone like Trump take power and bring all of this to the fore, I think if we don't reckon with history, we're in deep, deep trouble as a country, no matter what happens during these elections.
You talked about Black Lives Matter, the movements of immigration rights. I wanted to end with the Catholic workers, the Catholic peace activists in Georgia. Catholic peace activist Patrick O'Neill sentenced to 14 months in jail Friday for breaking into the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in Georgia to protest nuclear weapons policy. He's part of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7 group of Catholic peace activists who entered the base on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. Can you talk about the significance of this in the last 20 seconds we have?
I've said for a long time the greatest danger that the world has faced from Donald Trump is the possible threat of a first strike nuclear weapon that happens as a result of some tweet that Trump doesn't like from a foreign leader. These Catholic peace activists during the Trump administration tried to confront that nuclear threat, and there was a total media blackout on the action that they did. If we lived in a just society, the Kings Bay Plowshares activist trial would have been reported on as one of the most brave confrontations of the most dangerous aspect of this government and particularly this administration.
We have to leave it there. Jeremy Scahill, co-founder of The Intercept, will link to your American Mythology series podcast, Intercepted. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, protests against police brutality and racial injustice continued over the weekend, with demonstrators gathering outside the ICE building in South Portland. The Portland NAACP has voted for the resignation of branch manager Edie Mondanay, and a federal judge has stopped a Trump administration rule that would have cut food stamps for hundreds of thousands of people. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 19th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. This past Saturday, hundreds of protesters gathered at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility in Southwest Portland. They came together to challenge the Trump administration's ongoing detention of immigrant families and children and to honor those who have died in ICE custody. Independent journalist Brian Conley was at the protest and spoke with KBOO about the demonstration.
Protesters have continued to come out every night, even though the major media has stopped reporting on it after a while. And on Saturday night, the focus was a solidarity march in honor of those who have died in ICE custody. Can you talk about how that march started and what the scene was down on Southwest McAdam on Saturday?
Yeah, so I wasn't there right at the beginning. I guess it started in Willamette Park, which is a different location. Usually folks going to ICE, they meet up at Elizabeth Carruthers, which is a bit north. Willamette Park is quite a bit farther and then actually south of the facility, I believe. When I showed up, it was around 10:30, and I found this like very strange scene. There were maybe a half a dozen vehicles, mostly dark SUVs, actually blocking Moody Avenue north of the ICE facility, which was several blocks from the federal property, which, as I understand it, they're not really supposed to be out beyond much beyond that first intersection. But when I showed up, there was a bunch of these vehicles there, and I guess they must have been there for a little while because the protesters were not nearby, and then they protesters suddenly were kind of marching up towards them, and this kind of very tense scene ensued where the officers were trying to leave and protesters were blocking the vehicle. Then one officer, I believe from, you know, just DHS or that Federal Protective Service branch, began firing pepper balls at the protesters, and then they sort of backed up and cars drove off. And then after that, it you know, proceeded back to the ICE facility. And, you know, throughout the evening, it was kind of back and forth. They would get pushed away, then they would go back, then they'd be pushed away, et cetera.
And from the footage I saw, it seemed there was some sort of action involving balloons. Were the balloons representative of people who had died in ICE custody? It seemed like people were trying to tie those balloons on to the gate in front of the ICE.
There were balloons originally tied to the front, as well as by the time I got there, they'd mostly been removed. There was, I think, one balloon, you know, one lone balloon still on the side gate, kind of on the east and sort of back area where there's sort of less visibility to the security forces. I believe many of the balloons had names of individuals who'd been in ICE custody.
And what did you experience as far as the federal officers? How did they treat you as a journalist covering this? Were you wearing a press vest?
Yeah, so I was wearing a press vest. I was carrying my two camera bodies, you know, wearing a helmet. You know, I was also wearing a red and orange flannel, you know, definitely not like Antifa Black Bloc kind of gear. I mean, that's sort of my approach is I've always tried to dress as much like a, you know, middle-aged dad as possible. but in fact, you know, what we've seen is although that the camouflage folks who I think are mostly BORTAC, sort of border tactical operations folks, although they seem extremely militarized, in my experience, they've actually been more reserved and kind of more organized than the FPS officers, who don't really seem to care about anything. You know, they just do whatever they feel like. And actually, you know, that, you know, Saturday night was no exception when the officers started shooting at the crowd and then started pushing back. And I was kind of, you know, trying to move back quickly, you know, to give them space and also to continue filming. And I actually had one officer charge directly at me and knock me to the ground, actually onto another photojournalist. And the photojournalist I fell onto, I think actually he has a broken finger now. And I believe from being kicked by the officer, he seems to have nailed me as he's charging into her. You know, and then I said, hey, look, press, you know, there's TRO. And the guy said nothing. And then I realized I had dropped my phone. And it was fortunately still sitting there on the ground in between the two of us, the police officer and myself. And, you know, at this point, you know, 30 seconds or a minute has probably gone by, but he had plenty of time to register that I was a member of the press and, you know, to see what was up and to understand that he is currently legally barred from firing pepper balls at me or arresting me or sort of enforcing a dispersal unless I've done something like clearly outside of the bounds of you know, journalistic work and then press coverage. But as I went down to pick up my phone, the officer actually began shooting pepper balls directly at my phone in the area around it. So, it's, I mean, you kind of have to laugh because it's so absurd. But
they attacked your phone with pepper balls?
Yeah. As I was trying to pick up my phone, they started shooting at the area around the phone, like kind of, I guess, trying to prevent me from retrieving my phone, which was still recording. So you can kind of sort of hear the pepper balls kind of ricocheting around. It's quite loud from the crowd and everything, but you can hear it a little bit.
What were the protesters doing at the time when the officers advanced?
Well, I mean, generally, for the most part, the protesters were kind of peacefully assembling. I mean, it just seemed that the federal officers either had been given some kind of tacit approval or just didn't care that they were, you know, repeatedly leaving federal property. And actually, you know, there were times when they were attacking protesters blocks away from the federal building when they could have simply retreated.
And again, if people want to find information about a protest, there is a website, pdx-blm-events.org, that compiles these protests, not just as you were mentioning, Black Lives Matter events, but abolish ICE and other actions. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
Over the weekend, the Oregon Health Authority reported 608 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of confirmed and presumptive cases up to 38,935. Oregon health officials also reported 3 more deaths, raising the state's death toll up to 617. Over the past 2 weeks in the state, coronavirus cases have risen more than 24%. Oregon Governor Kate Brown is being sued by a trio of Republican lawmakers who accuse her of abusing her authority by issuing stay-at-home orders and placing restrictions on businesses in response to the coronavirus pandemic. The lawsuit is being brought by State Representatives Werner Reschke of Klamath Falls, Mike Nerman of Independence, as well as State Senator Dennis Linthicum of Klamath Falls and Washington County businessman Neil Ruggles. The suit alleges the governor violated the state constitution and usurped the legislator's power when she issued executive orders at the beginning of the pandemic. The Oregon Department of Justice said they are reviewing the lawsuit. Nationally, as of Monday morning, more than 8.2 million people in the United States have been infected with COVID-19. At least 219,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there have been an average of 56,000 cases per day, an increase of 30% from the average we saw 2 weeks ago. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 40 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.1 million people have died across the world. A Portland protester is speaking out following an unwarranted arrest in August, where during detainment she was forced to take a pregnancy test. Ellen Bennington was part of a demonstration held August 31st, which was in proximity of Mayor Ted Wheeler's residence in the Pearl District of downtown Portland. Several hundred people gathered, playing music and chanting, until Portland police arrived in riot gear and disbanded the protesters after declaring it a riot. Bennington was following that order when a police van approached her, and in the crowd she was walking with, they arrested her and others with charges of disorderly conduct, interfering with a police officer, and resisting arrest. Other arrests from the same evening included a couple not involved with the protests, but who were merely walking home from dinner before getting caught up in the chaos. After being transported to the Multnomah County Detention Center, Bennington refused to answer questions and asked to speak to a lawyer. Following interrogation as to her mental health, jail medical staff informed Bennington she would need to submit a urine test to determine if she was pregnant or face disciplinary action. Bennington says she eventually gave in, and after stripping in front of several female guards, was put in prison scrubs and detained in a horrifically soiled solitary cell, where she remained until noon the following day. Fellow protester Rachel Miles was arrested at the same protest, and witness officers booking Bennington, noting the pregnancy test seemed unwarranted. She told Bennington, quote, "I can't tell you what to do, but this is not a choice. This is coercion under duress." Miles was then surrounded by officers and given a disciplinary timeout, being placed in a solitary cell without explanation. A spokesperson for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office said that taking urine samples to determine pregnancy for women in custody is not unheard of for an individual assigned to housing. Juan Chavez, an attorney with the Oregon Justice Resource Center, says it reeks of unlawfulness. They said, quote, "I just can't see a risk management scenario that would justify a mandatory pregnancy test." In a 2018 Oregon Supreme Court ruling, the court decreed the police may not obtain an individual's heart rate or collect breath, blood, or urine without consent or a valid warrant. Upon her release, Bennington, who continues to participate in ongoing protests, says she thinks the police were using the test as an intimidation tactic, making things harder than necessary. Charges brought forth against both Bennington and Miles have been dropped. In an emergency meeting on Friday evening, the Portland NAACP board voted 7-3 in favor for the immediate resignation of branch manager Edie Mondanay following recent allegations of abuse. 3 men, all congregation members at Celebration Tabernacle, where Mondanay is the chief pastor, have accused him of sexual, psychological, and emotional abuse. The allegations are supported by an additional 8 church members. One of the 3 alleged victims lived with Mondanay and worked with him at a restaurant that Mondanay ran for over a decade. He claims he was never paid and was forced to live off of tips alone. Mondaney has denied the allegations and says he will continue to serve the remainder of his term despite Friday's vote, though he has withdrawn his re-election bid for the presidency of the NAACP's Portland branch. The allegations recount multiple instances of sexual abuse, spanning from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s for the three men, with repeated accounts of emotional and psychological abuse accounted by many others. This is not the first bout of controversy for Mondaney. He faced allegations of misusing NAACP funds earlier this year. Those allegations were brought by Rise Up PDX, an accountability group dedicated to the financial integrity and NAACP program leadership transparency. Mondaney has been the president of Portland's NAACP chapter since 2018, after the chapter's previous president, Joanne Hardesty, was elected to Portland City Council. Amid recent months of unrest, Mondaney could be seen frequently front and center at rallies and marches decrying racial injustice and police brutality following the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police in May. One of Mondaney's accusers said of his public persona to the Portland Mercury, quote, "We had to see his face on TV. We saw him lauded as some great man, some hero, a kind man, and to be drugged through our trauma again and again, and we were powerless against him." Mondaney's first term is set to expire after the NAACP elections on November 21st. More than 59,000 ballots have already been received in Multnomah County just 3 days after they were mailed out. That's the equivalent to about 10% of registered voters in the county. It's also a much faster pace than in 2016's presidential election, when it took 6 days to reach equivalent numbers. Jim Moore is a political scientist at Pacific University. He said, quote, "The very early turnout seems to match what we're seeing across the country. The turnout looks like it's about 30% ahead of where it was in 2016. In Multnomah County, the number of registered voters has grown by 12.5% since 2016. The growth is due in large part to the passage of Oregon's Motor Voter Act, which took effect in January of 2016 and made voter registration automatic when Oregonians obtain or renew their driver's licenses. As of Friday, more than 22 million Americans had already cast their ballots in the 2020 election. That represents 16% of all the votes cast in the 2016 election, even as 8 states are not yet reporting their totals and voters still have more than 2 weeks to cast ballots. The rush to vote has led election experts to predict that a record 150 million votes may be cast, and turnout rates could be higher than in any presidential election since 1908. Oregon has seen turnout rates between 80 and 82% of registered voters in the last two presidential elections. You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at the Yes to PDX Schools initiative and those pushing against Measure 110, the drug decriminalization measure. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 59. Today in history, in 1985, the first Blockbuster store opens in Dallas, Texas. The store was a success, and Blockbuster expanded rapidly, eventually becoming one of the world's largest providers of in-home movies, before eventually filing for bankruptcy in 2010. The quote of the day is from theoretical physicist Albert Einstein, who said, quote, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it." A federal judge has struck down a Trump administration rule that would have cut food stamps for nearly 700,000 people. In the ruling released on Sunday, U.S. District Court Chief Judge Beryl Howell wrote that the rule, quote, "racially and abruptly alters decades of regulatory practice, leaving states scrambling and exponentially increasing food insecurity for thousands of Americans." The rule, released in December by the Department of Agriculture, formalized a proposal for work requirements for recipients of food stamps. It would have disqualified an estimated 688,000 people from getting food benefits. The program is formally known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. It provides food benefits to around 38 million people. That's as of 2019. Judge Howell wrote in the ruling that the Department of Agriculture, which administers the food stamp program, had been silent about the number of people who would be affected by its proposed reduction in benefits. One estimate from May found that during the coronavirus pandemic, quote, SNAP rosters have grown by over 17%, with over 6 million new enrollees. The Texas Board of Social Work Examiners has voted unanimously to change its code of conduct to remove protections for sexual orientation, gender identity, and disability. This means that Texas social workers will be able to turn away LGBTQ clients and those with a disability. The move came after a recommendation from Governor Greg Abbott. Abbott's office said the change was suggested because the board's non-discrimination clause went beyond the state's policy on social work. Many advocacy groups and professional organizations said this could put already vulnerable, disabled, and LGBTQ people at a greater risk. Ricardo Martinez is the CEO of the statewide LGBT group Equality Texas. He said in a statement, quote, "The social worker's code of conduct previously helped ensure ethical treatment of all clients and prevented bias-motivated misconduct. Now, with the removal of sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression from the code, LGBTQ plus folks who experience discrimination could face more obstacles to getting the help they need." The National Association of Social Workers also criticized the board's acceptance of the governor's recommendation. Emmett Schelling is the executive director of the Transgender Education Network of Texas. They said, quote, "There is always a real possibility that trans Texans specifically could be turned away or dissuaded from accessing the medical resources they need at a time when many in our community require services to make it through this isolating pandemic. Attempting to grant providers a license to discriminate is abhorrent." Litigation is ongoing on ballot receipt deadlines, witness signatures, and drop boxes. And early voting starts this week in a dozen states. With more on the story, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Given how much is going on in the country, there are more than 300 cases pending right now in almost every state litigating the conduct of the election, an unprecedented volume of lawsuits.
They're all about voter access, lower court decisions to expand the vote, extend ballot receipt deadlines, strike witness signature requirements, and not limit drop boxes have been overturned by appeals in a number of crucial battleground states. Wendy Weiser is with the Brennan Center for Justice.
These cases are now barreling towards conclusion as the election is already underway.
The latest was in Michigan, where ballots need to be received by election day, not just postmarked and received within 2 weeks. Other cases in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, plus some states that hadn't been considered in play until 2018.
Voter purges and photo ID and not putting working equipment in black precincts and not enough polling places.
Green Party presidential candidate and former Teamster Howie Hawkins says voter suppression might make this presidential election close, not any third-party candidacy.
The battleground states have moved from the upper Midwest down to Republican strongholds like Georgia and Texas and Arizona.
In 2018, Georgia Democrat Stacey Abrams lost her bid for governor by just 2.2%. She's been fighting voter suppression since then, especially with coronavirus limiting some folks' ability to vote in person and Trump administration changes at the post office.
Georgia unfortunately operates under a voter suppression standard that says that it has to arrive by election day, even though you have no idea what's happening with the post office.
A new study by the group Take Back the Court found that 85% of Trump-appointed federal judges have issued what they call anti-democracy decisions, rulings making it harder to vote. With just 15 days until the election, former VP Joe Biden and President Trump are ramping up campaigning. Biden is vastly outpacing Trump in ad spending. His fundraising allows a nearly 2-to-1 airwave advantage. Just 10 days after, the FBI uncovered a far-right-wing plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The crowd at a Trump rally chanted, quote, "lock her up," with the president saying, quote, "lock them all up." Whitmer later condemned Trump, saying that's the kind of rhetoric that put her in danger. Voting is already underway in Michigan and other states. More than 26 million votes have been cast overall. Massachusetts and Nevada begin over the weekend, and about a dozen more start this week. Fenway Park, home of the Red Sox, opened for voters on Saturday. More than 40 stadiums are being converted into polling stations nationwide. And in Nevada, registered voters are automatically getting ballots in the mail for the first time. Carrie Dermick is with the state chapter of All Voting is Local.
We've never had this many options. You have all the way until Election Day to register to vote.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Confrontation over indigenous fishing rights escalates in eastern Canada, and Donald Trump Jr. traveled to Arizona to launch the Native Americans for Trump Coalition. With those stories and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, and for Antonia Gonzalez. There was another incident over the weekend in the dispute over lobster fishing on Canada's east coast between Indigenous and non-Indigenous fishermen. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a southwest Nova Scotia lobster plant was destroyed by fire, and one man is in the hospital with critical injuries.
The dispute so far has seen property destroyed, confrontations, injuries, and calls for more police protection, even military intervention. The latest incident came over the weekend as a lobster pound was leveled by fire. The chief of the Sepikadakati First Nation, Mike Sachs, says the pound was owned by a friend and ally to the Mi'kmaq.
Community members are working with the people that own those pounds, and the industry doesn't like that, so they're forcing anyone that's dealing with us out of the industry. It's the last thing we want is for anyone to be hurt, for everyone to be safe. We're not here to fight.
Sachs says if there had been more police on duty near the site, the fire likely would not have taken place. This dispute has been escalating over the past couple of weeks after Native lobster fishermen took to the waters out of season, claiming it is their treaty right to fish wherever and whenever they want, a right that was upheld by the Supreme Court of Canada 20 years ago, so they can earn a modest living. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for commercial fishermen who are angry over the Mi'kmaq fishing out of season are also appealing for calm. She says if the federal government was doing its job, this would not be happening. Nova Scotia's Premier Stephen McNeil is calling on Ottawa to define how much lobster the Mi'kmaq can harvest to determine what is a moderate livelihood. He says that has to happen before the province can look at its own regulations. He says his government is working with Ottawa to try to bring all sides together for a respectful dialogue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Donald Trump Jr. was in Arizona late last week to launch the Native Americans for Trump Coalition. The Arizona Daily Sun reports Trump Jr. joined Navajo Nation Vice President Myron Leiser and several local candidates at a rally in Williams. There were about 400 people from northern Arizona and several tribal nations at the event. President Trump will hold a rally in Prescott on Monday. Trump Jr. argued the Trump administration has been a better ally to tribes than Democrats and used coronavirus aid as an example. The Navajo Nation, which was hit hard by the pandemic, did get more than $700 million through the CARES Act, but had to sue the administration before it and other tribes received funds. Leiser said at the rally that he believes if Trump is reelected, he will help the Navajo Nation improve its economy and health care. A new 50-megawatt solar field broke ground recently on the Jicarilla Apache Nation in northern New Mexico. It's the third largest solar project on tribal lands in the United States and will produce power for Albuquerque and other large users. Jicarilla Apache Nation President Edward Velarde said the project is part of an ongoing effort by the Jicarilla to control its own energy. Smart Cities Dive reports the tribe created its own power authority in 2014. The solar field will provide 2 megawatts of renewable energy back to the community. The project is a partnership with utility PNM. In Canada, officials have approved a statue of an Indigenous leader for the grounds of the Manitoba Legislature. It will be the first statue of a First Nations person at the site. The CBC reports a group of volunteers has been working for nearly 4 years to have a statue of Chief Peguis placed at the legislature. Peguis was a Soto chief and defender of First Nations rights. Bill Shedd, a member of the Peguis First Nation and co-chair of the committee organizing the statue, says Peguis was also a diplomat who helped bring people together and keep the peace. Shedd told the CBC the monument will fill a void.
I think that the project to get the monument is going to be the most important step in reconciliation between the Indigenous and the non-Indigenous people of the province.
Once funding and a location are finalized, organizers will put out a call for artists. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, Jenka Soderberg, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke and Megan Kamrick. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, we'll hear Alternative Radio, which features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, stage and studio host D. May Roberts presents the radio documentary Coming Home, Return of the Alutique Masks. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Jeannie Kenmatsu, the curator of Japanese art at the Portland Art Museum, about the show Japan's Women Printmakers, which is now on display at the museum. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This year's ballot includes Measure 26215, which renews the Portland Public Schools bond for building improvements. Supporters of the bond are calling it a historic investment in student equity. I spoke with Michelle DePass, a member of the PPS School Board and an active community advocate for housing, equity, and education, about what voters can expect from Measure 26215. As we get started, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
Yes, my name is Michelle DePass. I'm born and mostly raised in Portland, mother of two, single mother of two, who attended PPS during my childhood years. My kids also attended PPS, have been active in the community since I moved back from Southern California in 1991, and I serve on the Portland School Board.
So we're here today talking about the 2020 Portland Public Schools bond. And Michelle, would you just tell us just what you know about the bond? Give us some basics and then we can dig a little bit deeper.
Sure. So the bond is numbered 26215, and it's a $1.2 billion bond that pays for improvements, modernizations in Portland Public Schools. And $1.2 billion is a really large number, especially considering Portlanders, you know, dealing with the pandemic, comes many people have lost their jobs. But this is a tax that homeowners are currently paying, and it's a renewal of an existing tax measure. The bond will cover investments in curriculum and technology, so updating textbooks to reflect what we know about history, for instance, in the 21st century, investing in technology such that we can become, and we're close to becoming now, but a one-to-one school district where every child has not only a device that they can do schoolwork on, but also has some form of, some kind of a device that provides them access to the internet. And then the third part of the bond is modernization of the buildings. And so in this particular bond, it covers the modernization of Jefferson High School, $60 million in the bond for the development of a Center for Black Student Excellence, and preparing Cleveland and Wilson to go through their master planning process, their community engagement process, to get plans ready to submit to the city for permits.
Now, I have taught high school before, and even I am confused about what a bond is. I believe you touched on that with your introduction, but what is a bond and who ultimately is paying for it?
So a bond, and it's an excellent question, and it's something that I had to learn too, you know, at some point in my, you know, educational career. But a bond is a way of community members taxing themselves to provide the dollars needed to make typically infrastructure improvements. So I touched on the fact that this is a renewal of a tax that is added to our property tax bills if you're a homeowner, and probably passed down to renters in some form or the other as well. But it's a tax that we pay along with TriMet tax, parks and recreation taxes, Multnomah County library taxes, and they're a mechanism by which the community funds infrastructure investments.
And as you said before, current taxes will not be raised with this, correct?
There is not an increase in the tax rate. It's a rate that we are currently paying, and this is just a renewal or extension of that. It's extending it out. It's extending that rate out into the future.
So school board worked together and voted on the new bond this summer, and I've been reading and multiple less expensive options were introduced. So what factors led you to the acceptance of this, you know, a historically expensive plan in a time when, you know, resources are tight?
Sure. So yes, resources are tight and we're in a pandemic, which is just nerve-wracking for anyone. And yet this is the perfect time to make those investments. We had been talking as a board about a smaller bond measure that was approximately half of what's currently on the ballot. And then George Floyd was murdered and the Black Lives Matter movement sort of emerged, or I should say it's been around since I was a child, in different forms of civil protests and civil unrest. But this was, George Floyd was murdered in May, and these discussions were happening over the summer, and we felt like it was a good time to address some of the inequities that we see in our schools. Those are things such as, I'll say African-American children in particular, and Native, we're not serving them very well. We have not traditionally served them very well. And so the bond, you know, addresses the Black Lives Matter movement in that the city's historic Black high school, Jefferson High School, will be modernized under this bond, and this additional investment in the creation of a Center for Black Student Excellence is a response to what we see in the streets and what our community members are calling for night after night.
And what can we expect from the Center for Black Community Excellence?
Yeah, so it's a Center for Black Student Excellence specifically, and we don't know what that looks like, and we don't know what that looks like because this will be a community-led visioning process. So we're not coming in as a public entity saying, you know, this is what we're going to give you. We're coming with money saying, asking, you know, what does this look like? Is this a single building somewhere? Is it a scattered site program? So I don't have the answers to that. And I don't want to even claim to. I'm really looking forward to hearing from the community in terms of, you know, what they envision, what's needed, what holes can be filled with this this center.
All right. And as of right now, Portland students are learning from home due to the Oregon Department of Education's COVID-19 standards. And this decision has met some controversy among parents, some students, staff. One of the criticisms of the remote learning model is that it doesn't provide enough support for students with special needs. Does this bond include additional resources for these students?
That's an excellent question, and it's an excellent observation. So currently, the buildings within PPS portfolio are not fully compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The bond, and I failed to mention earlier, does include money to outfit the first floor of every building within our portfolio to accommodate children with special needs. But in addition to children with special needs, you know, we've got, but currently if someone has special needs and the school is not prepared for them, they have to go elsewhere. The children have to be educated elsewhere. So this at least, you know, gets us closer to meeting those Americans with disability standards. Those aren't just for kids though. I mean, making our buildings compliant helps people that are old, anybody with mobility issues, parents with strollers, et cetera. So it's not, you know, it's a way of kind of demonstrating our commitment to having a welcoming and inclusive environment for all students, and in every building within our portfolio needs to be welcoming and inclusive for all students.
So risk of COVID-19 infection isn't the only safety issue facing students in our public buildings. Could you speak to specific health and safety improvements included in the bond?
So yes, the bond naturally includes things such as, you know, repairing or replacing roofs. And under the building code currently, whenever you replace a roof, you also need to do the seismic improvements to the building. So those things will happen, and you know, they're not as exciting as, you know, having a brand new building, but they're very necessary, particularly because, you know, we're expecting an earthquake at some point. Health and safety issues were a big issue several years ago when we found that there was lead in the water, and some of those infrastructure issues had emerged. Those have largely been addressed. Portland Public Schools buildings average about 80 years old. And if you live in an old home, you know that it comes with these environmental hazards that they're not safe for anybody. So those have largely been addressed through prior work.
So the bond passed the school board, I believe, unanimously this summer, and there doesn't seem to be any organized opposition to it, but are there any misconceptions you've encountered regarding the bond, you know, with public opinion?
We've got some, we have had some people in the African-American community in particular state that they're not supportive of the bond for very real reasons, and you're right that we don't have any that we know of organized opposition. We have quite a bit of support from community groups such as the Albina Vision Trust, the Sunrise Movement PDX, Stand for Children, Latino Network, Northwest Disability Support, etc. We've gotten support from the Portland Association of Teachers. That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. Chambers of Commerce, Black American Chamber, Boz Media, Forum Law Group, Melvin Mark, and a whole host of elected officials and local leaders who stand behind our effort to make this a historic investment in PPS schools, but particularly in the Black community.
So as a longtime Portlander and former Portland student, what are you the most excited about with this bond?
Well, I'm really excited about Jefferson. I attended Jefferson for 2 years in the 70s. They had an amazing dance program. They still have an amazing dance program, but it's quite different than it was, 40 years ago. So I'm really excited about that. I'm also really excited about the complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act. I think that that's, you know, this is an act that passed, I think their 30-year anniversary was recently, and that we're a publicly funded institution that's not compliant has been a something that, you know, I've been ashamed of personally. So I'm happy that we're going to be taking the steps with this bond measure to address those accessibility concerns.
All right. Well, those are all of the prepared questions I have for you. Do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Sure. I know that this is, again, one of the measures that's on the ballot that puts equity front and center. I think that we've PPS has led in terms of actually addressing equity, you know, through this this historic investment. I'm urging people to get out and vote. It seems like 2020 has just been a crazy year, and we have a crazy, you know, local and national politics happening, but this is a great time as a community member to get out and vote on November 3rd to vote yes for 26215.
All right. Well, thank you very much for giving us your time, Michelle. I appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. This is awesome to get the word out.
Thank you again for all you're doing in the community. I looked you up before this. I was like, she's doing great things.
Yeah, working all the time. My family was in the Black Panthers when I was growing up. And so, you know, this is, you know, speaking out for what's right is not new to me. So,
yeah.
But this is a little bit of an extension of, you know, that kind of activism, you know, from the 60s and 70s. And now it's like, now I'm a school board member and I still get the opportunity to advocate for people in my community that, you know, have been underserved. And actually with equity, I mean, I think that our local government, and we're not sure how to operationalize it. You know, I think PPS is really like out in front in terms of like, this is how you do it. Like, you put money where your mouth is, you make investments in communities that you haven't served, so.
Well said. Well, thank you again, Michelle, for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been an interview with Michelle DePass from Portland Public Schools Board of Education. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful evening. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Samantha Law.
Just to get us started, would you mind telling me a little bit about yourself and your work and your role in the No On 110 campaign?
Right. So my name is Mike Marshall. I'm the executive director of Oregon Recovers, which is the only statewide recovery community advocacy organization in the state. And we're comprised of people like myself who are in long-term recovery, our friends and family, and then the treatment providers and certified alcohol and drug counselors and the addiction doctors and everything else. We have about 50 organizations that support our work, and annually have about 2,500 people participate in our policy roundtables, our walks for recovery, our summits. So, and our mission is to transform the existing fractured and complete addiction recovery system into a recovery-oriented continuum of care.
Some say it seems a little counterintuitive for you folks to come out against Measure 110, which is meant to decriminalize most misdemeanor drug offenses and reallocate marijuana tax revenue into a grant program meant to strengthen and expand health-centered approaches to drug treatment. Could you tell me what made you folks decide to come out against Measure 110?
Right. So Oregon Recovers has spent the last 3 years building a coalition of folks advocating for profound systems change and more money into the system. So you're right, you would think that we would support this, but the fact that we don't should make everyone pause and understand that it's not what it appears to be. First of all, decriminalizing drugs for both adults and children at the same time, prior to actually creating a pathway to recovery for them, means that people will have treatment cut off from them, both children and adults, and immediately the overdose rates will go up. And it's not unlike 40 years ago when advocates pushed to close the mental hospitals because they didn't think they were, and they weren't, achieving their purpose, but they did so before building up a healthcare system that could deal with folks with mental health issues. And so instead of pushing them into the healthcare system, we pushed them out onto the streets. And that's what Measure 110 does. It cuts off a pathway to recovery for those folks who the healthcare system has failed the most. So they've ended up engaging in criminal activity, which has led to them being charged with possession. Nobody should be criminalized for their addiction, but until we build up a healthcare system that intervenes farther upstream so that our doctors and our nurses and our social workers and our teachers all have the tools and the capacity to intervene in someone's drug or alcohol use, then just cutting off a pathway to a treatment center is not the way to go.
Yeah. just to make it clear for listeners, what exactly is that specific pathway that would be cut off? Is that through the courts or hospitals or what?
Yeah, through courts. So right now, if you're charged with possession of a misdemeanor, you have access then to go to drug court, and a judge can send you to treatment and put you at the front of the line. We have very long treatment waiting lists, mm-hmm. but you can get to the front of the line if a drug court judge assigns you there. Or you can just stay in the criminal justice system, which in most cases in Oregon means you get probation. Nobody goes to jail anymore for just simple possession. Mm-hmm. But what's important is, and so by taking it from a misdemeanor to a violation, the money allocated to those drug courts are no longer can be spent on that person who only gets a violation. So what you're gonna have is kids getting a ticket instead of access to treatment because they were caught with meth or heroin, whatever the case may be. On top of that, because it's a violation, a ticket, most counties don't inform parents when a child gets a ticket. So all of a sudden you're gonna have a kid caught with drugs and not be given a pathway to treatment, and parents are not gonna know about it. And that is the wrong way to approach it. Let's instead first build up our healthcare system to be able to intervene with that child before they get a ticket or get arrested. It's putting the cart before the horse.
Mm-hmm. The approach that the current system has is still puts people into contact with the criminal justice system, which is known to be much more punitive towards Black and Brown communities. And a lot of people say that even having contact with that system from an early age in particular can saddle people with more issues that hinder their recovery process, like not being able to have access to housing, trouble getting a job because they have a record or misdemeanors or even felonies on their record. What do you say to people who bring up that point as well?
No, I think it's extremely valid. The problem is that healthcare system is equally defined by systemic racism. And so the goal here is to get people healthy and then to work backwards in terms of both expunging and mitigating those past impacts, mm-hmm. and preventing them from happening in the future. But if someone's dead, you can't help them. And so, you know, in recovery, we have a concept of, would you rather be right? Would you rather be happy?
Mm-hmm.
And Measure 110 is about the Drug Policy Alliance in New York, and now Mark Zuckerberg, for some reason, wanting to be right. They want to take this and go to another state where the legislature has not done as much work on decriminalization as we've done here in Oregon, and win. There's a reason no state has fully decriminalized drugs. And it's primarily because only since the Affordable Care Act have we begun to integrate addiction recovery into the healthcare system. And mm-hmm. we're just not there yet. So this notion of trying to prevent people of color from having to interact with the criminal justice system, I totally agree. But cutting off their pathway to treatment and recovery is not the way to do that. Mm-hmm. And the other part of this that's so lacking is nobody in Oregon is gonna go to jail today because they have meth or heroin in their pocket. Now, oftentimes when people interact with the criminal justice system and are found out of possession, it's because they got in a fight, they broke into a car, they had all these co-occurring crimes that are relative to their addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And way the current intervention system is set up is, at least at this point in Oregon, judges have the discretion and the resources to say, you go to treatment, I'll not only expunge the possession charge, but I'll also expunge your breaking and entering charge, your theft mm-hmm. charge, whatever the case may be. You take away the drug charge, and those courts can no longer do that. So you may very well see more people incarcerated for property crimes than was previously the case because they had a co-occurring possession charge. Mm-hmm. So I don't disagree that interacting with the criminal justice system is much different for people of color than it is for me, but the solution is not to just cut off their access to treatment and recovery and because they're still going to get a violation, and the violation is only going to occur once they're interacting with the criminal justice person, right? Taking away that hook, that ability to get people into treatment and recovery is really important. I used meth for 10 years, and because of my white privilege, I was never arrested. But I bet had I been, I would have gotten sober sooner and my life would have improved sooner if I hadn't lived the privileged life I had. If I had been arrested, I'm much more likely to have gotten into recovery much sooner than I did, because when I was using, I didn't want to be sober.
Thank you for that. What is the missing link in your opinion then for to get maybe more preventative treatment, as opposed to what the measure proposes, which is to reallocate marijuana funds in order to fund existing organizations that are providing that treatment or that like interventive care or supportive care, like housing assistance, job assistance, and things like that? What would be like a better use of those funds?
So first of all, those funds should stay in our schools and our county mental health programs. We don't need cannabis money. What we need is to increase the price of alcohol. Alcohol kills 5 times more people than drug overdoses and is a much larger contributor to the addiction crisis. Most people start to use alcohol before they use drugs. Underage drinking, as opposed to underage drug use, is much more significant. So we have not raised the beer or wine tax since the late 70s, and we have the lowest beer tax in the country. Mm-hmm. So there is legislation in 2021, and the governor has included in her budget as well, to increase the price of alcohol, which will reduce harmful consumption amongst underage drinkers and binge drinkers, which are the two most expensive alcohol consumers relative to foster care, crime, you know, homelessness, things like that. Those lead to those expensive public policy and health issues. So raise the price of alcohol, reduce consumption. If we raise the price of alcohol 20% across the board, that will generate upwards of $750 million to put into the system of care that the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission has spent the last 3 years designing, mm-hmm. that was delivered in February to the governor and the legislature. So there has been an arc of reform that has been taking place for 3 years that the Drug Policy Alliance in New York didn't want any part of. Because you said that we want the same thing, and I would disagree with that. They want to win decriminalization, which no other state has done this. Oregon would be the first, and you have to ask your question, why would we do that when we have the third highest addiction rate and we rank last in access to treatment? But more importantly—
It seems like the point to me for the Yes campaign would be that decriminalizing would free up funds, basically spend less money punishing people for something they've already done and put more funds into supportive care, which is preventative.
That's a misrepresentation. Most people today are not punished for possession of small amounts of drugs. They are if they're dealing, but that virtually every one of them is offered a pathway to treatment. If they choose not to do that, odds are they're put on probation. This notion that everyone's being imprisoned because of their drug possession is just not correct. 2/3 of the inmates in the, you know, like 10,500 of the 14,000 people that are incarcerated in our prisons in Oregon have a substance use disorder diagnosis that merits treatment that they're not receiving treatment for. So we don't have a crime problem. We have a drug and alcohol problem, but they're not incarcerated because of drug possession. They're incarcerated for these much more significant crimes that they committed after a trajectory of increased drug and alcohol use, and probably multi-generational drug and alcohol use. So instead of diverting important cannabis tax revenue away from the schools and the county mental health programs that the voters intended it for, our solution here needs to be in the next session, raising the price of alcohol to reduce harmful alcohol consumption. And then it will generate probably 10 times the amount of revenue that measure 110 ultimately will direct into the system. So we need to be thoughtful. We need to come at this from a public health lens and not just a criminal justice lens, which is what the advocates for 110 are actually doing. And recognize that until we build a new system of care within the healthcare system, the net effect of taking away access to treatment via the criminal justice system is to throw people out onto the streets, not to help them get them into recovery. Now, they won't necessarily have a criminal record, but they may very well be dead as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's a great place to wrap up. Thank you so much, Mike, for your time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934